The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's show, Daniel Blumstein will be telling us if we can induce fear by smell alone. And does your DNA make you more likely to get bored easily? If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewsTalkScience. You can text us for 30 cents 53106. We get your comments in the podcast. Find it in the News Talk app or wherever you find your podcasts. Just search for Future Proof. All right, as always, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined via Skype by Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Dungan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Is about a study from Denmark that I got a few private tweets about, actually, Lara. People saying, well, you're going to change your tune now that science is out, Jonathan? And I said, well, it's one study. So I thought before I made a decision on it, I'd just ask the experts. So can you tell us what, because I'm not sure. This is a study that looked at face masks and their efficacy. What did it say and what can we take from it?
Okay, so some people will definitely have heard of this study during the week, and you're dead right. Some people are using this to sort of say, well, science, what do you say now? So let's look at what the science of this study shows. And it's a good study and the science has done well. So what they wanted to do was ask a question, and their question was, observational evidence suggests that mask wearing does reduce transmission of SARS-CoV-2, which, as we know, is the virus that causes COVID-19. They wanted to know whether it is the person wearing the mask is protected by the mask, or whether or not it's more likely that that person is not giving SARS. So what they did was they had about 6,000 people, around about 4,800 completed the study. So it's around about 2,500 people in each group completed this study. And they did it at a time when SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 was quite low in the environment in Denmark. And they recommended that everybody do the normal social distancing and hand washing and the normal infection control parameters. And they asked half of them to wear a surgical mask when they were out of the house. And half of them, they just said to do the normal things. So washing your hands and social distancing. This is at a time, if everyone remembers, at the start of the pandemic, when masks weren't actually commonly worn. You know, we had to make it a legal requirement to wear masks in shops and indoors in Ireland before people would take this up. And what they found was, factually, what they found was that in the part of the study where the people wore masks, 1.8% of them got COVID-19, got the virus that causes COVID-19. In the half of the study that didn't wear masks, 2.1%. So that's 1.8 versus 2.1%. These numbers are very close. And what it says is there's no statistical significance to wearing a mask. So if you are a person wearing a surgical mask, you are almost as likely to catch COVID-19, not quite as likely, but almost as likely as if you are not wearing a mask. Now, there is a small reduction, but it's not statistically significant, which means when you put the numbers on it, it's not, the significance value isn't there. So that is the fact. The fact is that you are almost as likely to catch the virus. What they didn't research, and what they are very happy to admit they didn't research, is whether or not you are then not passing on your virus to other people. And this, as we all know from the publicity regarding masks, that is the idea behind mask wearing. It's, I'm not wearing this necessarily for me, I'm wearing this for you. You know, for instance, for me, I'm in a hospital all day, every day, and I'm you know, potentially exposed to SARS-CoV-2. I wear a mask to protect those around me. I obviously do also wear very heavy protective equipment if I'm going into somebody who has the virus, but I wear my mask to protect others. And this data doesn't even assess that. And they don't want to have assessed that. They are just saying one simple fact, wearing a surgical mask is not really going to protect you yourself. And that's so fine, and that's a fact.
There's two things we have to take from that. The first is how important social distancing is, not staying in the same room when it's not ventilated for long with people outside of your bubble and so on, that those things are really important because the mask does not protect you.
Exactly.
But the other is, if it doesn't protect you from getting the virus, would that not also imply that it doesn't protect others if you're wearing one? Or what is the thinking there?
It definitely doesn't imply it. One of the things we know is that SARS-CoV-2, the virus, is aerosolized, which means that, for instance, as you were saying, if you are in a closed room with a person for 15 minutes, if the person has the virus, you can expect that they are breathing it out, coughing it out, and the air will become saturated with this virus. So you still have to breathe, and there's all sorts of little areas around a surgical mask where you breathe in the air. So it makes complete sense that if you are wearing a surgical mask, now this isn't the very heavily protective surgical mask, this is a standard normal mask that people can buy in their local shop.
Yeah.
It makes sense that the air is coming in around the sides and the virus can come in. That makes total sense. But one of the key things that transmits the virus is talking, singing, coughing, sneezing, these kind of things.
Shouting.
And there is shouting, exactly. And there is a huge amount of evidence that shows masks do stop a lot of transmission. You can see from videos, you can see people looking at particles when they have a mask on and when they don't. It is reducing the amount of virus that is getting out of you if you are a person who is infected. Now, I can't tell you if 100% sure from a randomized clinical trial that it's reducing the amount that people are catching it from others, but you know, a lot of observational evidence is saying that it is reducing it. So this paper is not for a second trying to tell people not to wear masks. It's just saying that the reason that if you're going to wear them, which you should, it is to protect others rather than yourself.
And also remember how important that social distancing part
Absolutely.
Is. Okay. Our second story, Shane, I suppose maybe the significance of it was lost on some, but we had astronauts travel to the International Space Station on a private spaceship, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So lots of listeners will know that the space shuttle no longer does the journey from the United States to the International Space Station, and it hasn't done that since 2011. And since then, non-Russian astronauts have had to go in a Russian Soyuz capsule. So they've had to kind of, you know, team up with the Russians to get into space. And that's actually worked remarkably well, given other things that have been going on between the United States and Russia. But just this week, the first private rocket took off that had, it's a well-known SpaceX rocket, but atop this rocket, they had a Dragon capsule called Resilience for the year that's in it. And inside of it, there were three Americans and one Japanese person. And it represents the first private shuttle going into space. And I think it's an incredible step forward for this area.
What can you tell us about this mode of transport and what it means for not just space travel, but also SpaceX?
Well, SpaceX and Boeing were charged by the United States government through NASA to come up with an alternative for the space shuttle. And SpaceX got there first. And they have a reusable rocket, which is absolutely incredible, that they have this rocket and it takes off. The little bit that wants to go to the International Space Station separates at a certain point, and the rocket below it returns to Earth and can be reused. I think that's absolutely incredible that they're able to land a rocket in a safe way. What I can tell you about what this means then for space travel is that I suppose the United States and places like JAXA or the European Space Agency, they now have their own way to get into space. So they can choose when they want to go. They can bring what they want to bring with them. There are talk about tourists going into space. So SpaceX has said as early as next year, they will allow tourists to kind of go in one of these capsules and take a trip into outer space. It really is fantastic that we're kind of getting to the point now where there's commercial activity in this area. Joe Biden this week said, it's a testament to the power of science and what can be done when we harness innovation, ingenuity and determination. Not to be outdone, Donald Trump added that he thought it was quote unquote great.
This obviously heralds also an era of low cost space travel. I mean, the amount of money it cost NASA and the European Space Agency to get a project together to get a rocket into space was astronomical and such a barrier to space exploration, space commerce, space tourism, and so on. That, with this reusable rocket, has been really brought to a much more attainable level. And I know Ireland has got a number of little space ventures where people are looking at how to maximize their own research, their own innovation in this new era of low-cost space travel. But that said, while this rocket has been successful in testing over and over again, I think it's a brave person that for kicks would get aboard a rocket that's only a few years in testing and head out into outer space, taking on the risk, I suppose, of space travel.
Yeah, I also think it smacks a little bit of boys and their toys.
Yeah.
So I
would be pretty cool. It would be cool. I can't be totally two-faced about it. It would be pretty amazing to do that. Opportunity, of course, Shane, is studying for a very, very, very long time, mastering engineering, science, and becoming a multilingual guru. The requirements to get into space are pretty high. So.
Yeah, well, perhaps so. And I know which one of those you'd choose, Jonathan. It would be the hard
the easy route. The easy route. Lara, our third story has it's an interesting story about recreating the odors of yesteryear.
Yeah, I just think this is a really cool story. So scientists and historians from different universities across the UK and Europe have come together to form a team which is funded. There's about 2.8 million euro going into this project, and it's called Ode Europa. I can't quite find a way to say it that sounds like odor and Europe at the same time, but I know that's what they're going for. So it's Ode Europa. And what they're doing is they're going to, starting in January, use artificial intelligence to scan historical texts in 7 different languages to try and find references to aromas. And they're also going to use it to look at paintings to see if there's aromatic items within the paintings. And they're also going to look and see the emotions that might have been associated with that. So if a historical text mentions a particular smell and then talks about the emotion that it elicited in people. And then they're going to use this to hopefully in the future recreate certain smells. So they're going to work with perfumers who are going to potentially recreate these smells. And there is a visitor center in York. It's called the Jorvik Viking Center. And they have recreated the stench of the 10th century. And they use this as a feature. And a lot of people who visit this particular place say it's the most memorable part. And we all know that when you get a certain smell, it brings back a really forceful memory, whether it's good or bad for everyone. For instance, tobacco, when it was brought into Europe in the 16th century, it was considered this wonderfully exotic smell. And then, reasonably quickly, it became every day. And then by the 18th century, it became really repugnant and nobody liked the smell of tobacco. People didn't want it smoked indoors. So it's interesting how smells have evolved and the memories they can recreate. And so
I'm no doctor, Lara, but isn't that because our our nose bone is connected to our memory bone?
100%, Jonathan. And I'm glad you're the one to say it, because myself and Shane couldn't have put it so eloquently. But absolutely, our olfactory senses are definitely connected very readily to our memory centers in our brain. And it's quite a wonderful feeling to be able to recreate these memories or these scenes. And so they want to bring smells into museums so that you don't only have the sights of historical times, but potentially the sounds and then also the smells. So I just think it's
a nice idea. I think, the blunt tool of language perhaps isn't enough data to properly give people a translation of the olfactants that you're trying to create. If I said something, oh, it's a putrid stench of, wastewater and whatever, fine, but that's English. It's not, I haven't given you a chemical formula. I think it's a nice idea, but it's very aspirational to be able to say, well, this is what it smelt like in the 10th century toilet. But anyway,
let's see how they do. Believe in them, Jonathan.
Yeah. Well, why not? Shane, our final story has to do with, I suppose, a new area of love in my life, dogs.
Yes, you used to roll your eyes whenever I would bring forward a science story about dogs.
I'm not quite as bad as you. You're just obsessed. But I do see where it comes from.
So basically, this story is looking at the cleverness of dogs. And most people think that their own dog is clever, which is great. It shows loyalty to your dog. But when it comes to language learning in particular, some species or some breed of dogs stand out from the pack. And this is work that ethologists, that's people who study animal behavior in Budapest, are researching. And they're doing it in a very publicly friendly way. They have something called the Genius Dog Challenge that you can follow on YouTube. And it's just started and I've been watching it. And so dogs here are competing based on their capacity for language learning. So while most dogs can follow, language learning, exactly. So, but like most dogs can follow some language like sit or stay. They might know your name or a family member's name. But exactly that sort of stuff. But few dogs can remember objects by name. Now that's called receptive language, the ability to understand information given to you by language. And this is something that they're particularly interested in here and understanding the behavior. So they found six recruits through some scouring on social media. So you missed the boat on that one there, Jonathan. But I also think you have the wrong type of dog because all of the dogs
How dare you?
Yes. They're all border collies, so who are notoriously clever, the sheepdog. And what they do is you sit in a room and you say to your dog, go and get the chicken. And then the dog has to go off into another room and find their toy chicken, underlying the word toy chicken, from a selection of toys that belong to the dog. And so the dog has to know what that object means and bring it back to their owner.
I see. And the reason you don't have it in the room because you don't want to have that sort of clever hands, nonverbal communication as a tainting sort of factor, right?
Absolutely. So we know that dogs will often kind of infer what we're saying by where we're looking or gesture. So they have tried to control for that. And so they're understanding, basically, they're looking at these videos. This is what ethologists do. They will observe these videos and they'll try and understand what's going on. How did the dog process that language? And this is the first of many experiments that they're going to do with these six dogs. And you can watch them every Wednesday on YouTube. So
and
I know
what will we learn very quickly, Shane?
We'll learn about the way that they process language. And we learn they say a little bit about the basis of language itself, given dogs are social creatures like ourselves.
Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, double Dr. Laura Dungan. Thank you very much. Yes, you're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, picture yourself at home, slumped into your favourite chair. You're watching the clock. It's ticking. You feel fine, but there's something bothering you. You're restless, frustrated. So why don't you just get up and do something? Anything. There are a million and one things you could do, but you don't because you're bored. So what is this feeling of boredom and why do we have it? Well, Dr. James Dankert is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Waterloo and he joins me now. James, you're welcome to the programme. You know, I've experienced boredom in my lifetime, but I never really thought of it as a state or something that we could study in neuroscience. Is boredom a thing in neuroscience?
It absolutely is, but in your introduction, you've hit upon some of the key things about boredom, that it is both an absence of something and the presence of something, that when we're bored, we have a real motivation to be engaged. We want to be doing something that matters to us. But as you pointed out in your example, we don't want to be doing the things that are right in front of us. So there's a great quote from Leo Tolstoy that I like, where he describes boredom as the desire for desires. We have this kind of conundrum. We want something to be engaging, but we don't want what's currently available. And it's not a trivial experience. It's one that a lot of people experience and experience chronically, and it can have some negative outcomes. So it's absolutely a field of study.
So is it something that we can see in the brain, like when it comes to, you know, alpha and beta and gamma waves, like do we have a certain state like we see sometimes in deep sleep when we're bored, or is it not that distinct?
There's a lot to unpack in what you're asking there. The research from decades ago did liken the physiological state of boredom to sleep, but then in other senses, the physiology of boredom is more of a high arousal state. And so that's been a debate in the literature for probably the last 40 or 50 years. I think at the end of that argument is that boredom is a mixed arousal state. We're sometimes quite agitated, quite restless, and we're sometimes quite low in energy when we're bored. And there's a sort of fluctuation between the two. with respect to the brain, we're still in the early days of research into what are the brain states that are associated with being bored. We've done some work using functional MRI, where we look at the brain states when we make people bored. So we induce them into a feeling of boredom, and we do that by having them watch a movie of two guys hanging laundry for 8 minutes. And what we find, it's a pretty terrible thing to ask people to do. I'm surprised we got that through ethics. But what you find is that there's a network of brain areas activated when people are bored that we call the default mode. And there's a range of brain regions that are part of the default mode network. And this network tends to be active when we don't have anything in front of us to do. We don't have any external task to do. I mean, it's been associated with things like mind wandering and daydreaming, things like sort of nostalgic reverie and even thinking and planning for the future. So when you don't have anything right in front of you to do and you sort of let your thoughts turn in internal and think about yourself or think about, you know, other kinds of things that are not right in front of you. But when we see that network in our hands, in our study, that's while people are being asked to watch a movie. There is something for them to do. It's just so thoroughly boring that they switch off and engage instead this default network. But as I say, we are in the very early stages of trying to understand what the brain states are that are associated with being bored.
I have spoken to an Irish researcher who's doing work in the area of mind wandering. And one of the things that really stuck out to me was the amount of time that we spend not focused on the tasks we think we are, that actually our minds wander a huge amount of the time.
Yeah, it does seem a bit surprising that that would be the case until you think about it in a sort of resource allocation sense, if you will. So when I walk to work, it takes me about 30 minutes each way to walk to work. And, you know, walking the streets to get to work is not a really tough task. It's a pretty easy thing to do. And so it doesn't use up all of my cognitive resources. So while I walk to work, I might let my mind wander. I might sort of imagine what I would do if I was prime minister, or, you know, what would I do if I won the lottery? Or I might actually spend it more profitably and think about, you know, what are my tasks ahead for the day at work? And I can do that because walking is not that hard. And so I have my mind wander a lot of the time, because a lot of the time what we do is not using all of our resources. And that then comes back to boredom. I think when we're bored, when we feel bored, it's because in part we're not using our full resources. We're not fully engaged with the world in ways that feel good to us. And so that's what boredom is signifying, that we need to be using our cognitive resources more effectively.
I remember reading in Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, he talked about two types of thinking, and that if we're walking, we can engage in sort of slight meandering thoughts. But if we're trying to do like a complex mathematical sum, walking becomes difficult, and that our brain, it needs to devote more resources to the actual thinking part, and actually moving seems hard. And I suppose this happens sometimes when we really have to make effortful thought, we stop what it is that we're doing. Is that anything to do with boredom, or the types of thinking that we have? Are they neurologically distinct types of thinking?
Certainly the more effort that you put into something, the harder it is. Otherwise, you know, what's the definition of effort? And that will necessarily have some different sorts of impacts on the neural networks that are involved and you know, how much activity is involved. What you're talking about there, I think, reminds me of this notion of opportunity costs. And this comes from behavioral economics and is something that I think Daniel Kahneman also talked about a little bit. The idea of opportunity costs is that any given thing that you do has a cost. That is, while I'm reading a book, I could be doing something else. I could be doing the gardening. Each of those things, reading a book, doing the gardening, has some reward value to me. So if I choose one over the other, I'm foregoing the rewards of that other activity. And that's the opportunity cost. And what rising effort and rising boredom might both signal is that there is a change in those calculations of opportunity costs. If something feels like it's too hard to do, or if something feels like it's boring and meaningless, then the other activities that I could do, the other things that I could be engaging in, now seem like they're much more rewarding and much, you know, more likely to satisfy me. And so the opportunity costs in that sense are rising. Whether or not those are distinct types of thinking, the thinking fast, thinking slow distinction that Kahneman makes. I'm not entirely sure how that might relate to whether or not a thing is effortful or boring, but certainly the opportunity costs model is an interesting one in saying that when we're bored, what we're really seeing is that the thing we're doing now is not rewarding enough, and we need to do something that is more rewarding to us in some way.
What use is studying boredom from a scientific point of view? I mean, of all the things a neuroscientist, a cognitive neuroscientist, might devote themselves to, boredom seems like an odd choice.
It does. Whenever I tell anybody at a social gathering, you know, what do you do? And you say, I study boredom, the first response is usually a chuckle. People don't seem to believe that it's something that you would study. There's a number of reasons why I think it's an important thing to study. And the first is that it's a fairly common human experience. And so in psychology and in science more generally, we want to understand the human condition. And so if you just ignore something that is quite common and ubiquitous, then you're ignoring an important part of the human experience. And second, it actually has consequences. I think people dismiss boredom as a kind of part of the furniture of life. It's just a thing. And so we can sort of treat it as trivia and move on from it. But it's anything but trivial. So we know from decades of research now that people who experience boredom more frequently also tend to struggle with other aspects of their mental health. They tend to have higher rates of depression and anxiety. They tend to have higher rates of aggression. And that can have actual outcomes, particularly in young people. And we know too that it's a barrier towards success in achievement settings. So, you know, if you're more bored while you're in school, and we know this from high school students and from university students, then you're not going to succeed as well as if you were able to fully engage with the material you're trying to learn. So it has consequences. Mm. And I think it's for that reason alone, it's important to study.
Are there certain personality types that are more likely to get bored, or is there a gene associated with the likelihood of getting bored?
I will come to the gene part in a second, but the personality traits first. There are certain things that we know that people who suffer from boredom or struggle with boredom more frequently and more intensely do have other kinds of features or profiles, if you like. So the one that we have spent most of our time looking at is self-control. And what we mean by self-control is the ability to marshal your thoughts and your emotions and your actions in the pursuit of goals. And people who have high levels of self-control tend not to experience boredom very much. And the opposite is true, that people who have lower levels of self-control do tend to experience boredom more. So that ability to sort of, pursue goals in effective ways is really important for keeping boredom at bay. And that brings us to also self-esteem. So people who are high in self-esteem don't tend to experience boredom as much either. And that notion really for us is that if you believe yourself to be effective in your life, that, you know, you choose goals, you choose a course of action to pursue those goals, and more often than not, you succeed. And that feels good, and you have that sort of belief in yourself that you are a successful person in engaging those goals, then you don't tend to experience boredom. But there's also a question about whether or not, you know, failure to have that kind of success in early stages of life might actually make you prone to boredom in later stages. We don't know that to be true just yet, but it's certainly an avenue that we're pursuing. As for the genes, we don't really know that yet. We are in the process of looking at certain sort of candidate genes that are important for self-control and self-regulation, and also genes that are important for the regulation of a neurotransmitter known as dopamine, which is important for representing value and reward in the brain. And so stay tuned for that. We are interested in seeing whether or not there's a genetic profile of the highly boredom-prone individual, but we just don't know it yet.
Is it a thing that people are becoming more bored nowadays because of the endless array of choices of things that they can do? The sort of analysis paralysis that people have. Is there anything in the research to suggest that having everything at our fingertips is actually making us more bored?
There is. It's difficult to do this sort of work and definitively answer that question for you. And it's something that we've worried about since, Socrates, who worried that, you know, writing things down was going to ruin our memory. But a sociologist by the name of Oren Clapp worried that, you know, because we had so much information at our fingertips and because we had sort of an onslaught of that information, that we were going to have an epidemic of boredom. And Oren was writing in 1986. So the kinds of technology he was thinking about was, you know, pagers and ghetto blasters and Walkmans and these kinds of things. And so I can only imagine what he might think about our current day. Certainly, if you think about it, one of the challenges with so much information at our fingertips is to try and separate signal from noise, right? So with all of that information just available in your phone, in your pocket, it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. There's so much of it, it's really hard to make sense of it all. And there is some evidence from John Alhai and his group in the University of Toledo that indeed some people have problematic relations with social media and their smartphones that are sort of driven by boredom. So that we turn to these things, we turn to the rabbit hole of social media, we turn to, you know, scrolling through Instagram and Twitter as a sort of pacifier for boredom. And for some people, it becomes an addictive thing to do. And so it's not, I don't want to be a sort of, claiming that there is an epidemic, because we don't know and that there probably isn't. And I don't want to sort of be hyperbolic about this. You know, anywhere between 4 to 12% of people will demonstrate this sort of problematic relationship with their smartphones and with social media. Mm-hmm. So it's not like all of us are falling into that trap. But for some people, it's certainly, you know, that pacifier relationship that they have with social media and the internet is not healthy for them.
I know there's an adage that boredom is key to creativity, and often I've told my kids being bored is good for you when they've complained about it after having just completed something 3 minutes earlier. Is boredom good for us at all? Is there any science or research to suggest that is?
We have to make a distinction between in-the-moment feelings of boredom, which we would call state boredom, and what we've kind of been alluding to earlier, individual sort of differences in trait boredom proneness. So if you're highly boredom prone, there's not a lot to suggest that there's anything good associated with that. But we would claim that the in-the-moment feelings of boredom, state boredom, is neither good nor bad. It's just a signal telling you that you need to explore your world, and what you do then is entirely up to you. You might engage in something that's, you know, not really very adaptive and not helpful. You might just stay at the pub and have one more pint because you can't think of anything better to do. Or you might engage in some creative activity. People want to believe that being bored might be good for you in that it might spur creativity. But I don't think that there's any good evidence to suggest that boredom makes you creative. Creativity is a challenging and multifaceted sort of thing that requires the cultivation of various sorts of skills. You know, it's not easy, but I think sometimes we think about people who are creative and we think, wow, they were just born that way. And that's not true. You know, artists practice and they have to learn and hone their skills. And so boredom is not going to be the thing that makes you all of a sudden, a genius on the guitar.
You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're speaking to Dr. James Dankert about the science of boredom. What about the behavioural studies that are done to research boredom? Because I find often the methodology of these psychological tests can often be fascinating. Can you take me through some of the behavioural studies looking at boredom and its effect on participants in the study?
Sure. I can take you through something that relates to this notion of opportunity costs that I talked to you about before. So Timothy Wilson and his colleagues, and I think one of the students on this paper, Aaron Westgate, is following some of this work up on boredom. They did a study in 2014 where they put people in a room with nothing but their thoughts to entertain themselves. So they took away their cell phones, they took away everything else. The room was quite bare, there was nothing in it. And for 15 minutes, you had to sit in the room with nothing but your thoughts to entertain you. And then they asked people at the end of it, well, how did you like that? What did you think about that? And so, you know, about a third of the people thought that was actually quite pleasant. I guess, you know, slowing down and having some time to think for some people is quite nice. But about a third of the people said it was quite unpleasant. And some of them mentioned that they found it to be quite boring. And the key thing, they did about 9 experiments. The last experiment is the one that's of interest. So in that final experiment, they put people in a room with nothing but their thoughts, but also one other option. They could self-administer an electric shock. Now, in that experiment, they experienced the electric shock before their 15 minutes began, and they had said it was unpleasant and they would pay money to avoid having that electric shock in the future. But then they got put into the room with nothing but their thoughts, and a great many of them self-administered electric shocks anyway. In fact, one guy administered electric shocks 196 times to himself in 15 minutes. And what that says to me is that A, they're not doing that out of curiosity, and it just sort of highlights that for some of us, we're not comfortable doing nothing. We are action beings. We want to be doing something. And so, you know, even administering an electric shock is viable. And then I can tell you about sort of two follow-up experiments that relate to that. One that we did in our lab, where we sort of replicated their work. We had people in a room with nothing to do but their thoughts. And then we had another group that we put in a room with nothing to do but their thoughts. But in that room, we placed a range of different things that they could have interacted with. There was a half-finished jigsaw puzzle. I stole a Lego Technic puzzle from my son, and that was half-finished in the room as well. There was even a browser open that they could sort of surf the internet. So there were all these activities that they could see that they could normally do, but we said, you can look, but you can't touch. And then we asked the two groups, the group with nothing in the room and the group with activities in the room, how boring it was. And the people who had activities in the room that they were not allowed to interact with rated that experience as being more boring. So this is the idea that when you have something available to you that you could be doing, but you're prevented from it, that boredom is higher. And the final thing then to say is that we followed that up with a study of people's experiences during the early stages of the lockdown. And we found that people with high boredom proneness were more likely to break the rules of social distancing. So for those individuals, it's like the constraint of the lockdown in the pandemic was just too much for them to bear, and they had to get out and act because the opportunity costs were so high for them.
Is it just humans that get bored?
No. So I want to suggest that boredom serves a purpose. It has a function in our lives. And if I was to suggest that that's the case, then at some point in our evolutionary history, boredom was selected for. And if that's true, then you ought to be able to demonstrate boredom in animals. Most people who own a dog, I would suggest you have experienced boredom in their pet. You know, if the dog's left alone for too long in the house, then, you know, you come home and you discover that you've got one of your shoes has been destroyed. Mm. That's a bored animal. That's an animal that wants to be doing something and can't figure out what they want to do. And so they destroy your shoe. But we want to be able to demonstrate these things scientifically. And so actually one of my favorite studies of all time comes from Georgia Mason and Rebecca Meager, who studied mink. And they did this fantastic experiment where they had two groups of mink, that one group that was housed in a fairly bland kind of cage with nothing for the animal to do, and one group that had cages that had lots of things that the animal could interact with. And they did that for 2 weeks. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, they showed all the animals different kinds of objects, objects that a mink would normally approach, so things that they like. Apparently to mink, a toothbrush is kind of like a laser pointer to a cat. They just go crazy for toothbrushes. So they showed them a toothbrush. Then they showed them sort of objects that the animal would normally avoid. So the silhouette of a predator or the smell of urine of a predator. And then they showed them neutral objects. And their logic was this. If the animals in the cage that had nothing to do, if they were depressed, they would show less approach to the interesting or likable objects. They wouldn't go to the toothbrush. If the animals in that bland cage were apathetic, then they wouldn't approach any of the objects. But if the animals in those cages were bored, then they would approach all kinds of objects indiscriminately. They wouldn't care whether it was a positive, a negative, or a neutral object. They'd just run towards it as if they were desperate for something to interact with. And that's what they found. That's exactly what they found, is that the animals in the bland cages rapidly approached all kinds of objects indiscriminately. And then at the end, and both groups of animals had been well fed, so they were sated, if you like. But they also then made available to both groups of animals some treats that the animal would like to eat normally. And the mink that were in the bored cages, the bland cages that were bored, those animals overate those treats. And we see this in humans as well. We see that humans tend to overeat when we're bored. So, animals can be bored. And I think that suggests a strong argument for this functional account of boredom, that it is a push, a call to action, a call to sort of explore your environment for something meaningful to engage with.
And finally, I suppose, with the election chatter that's going on at the moment, I'm thoughtful of the people who voted for Trump because they wanted some sort of change. And I'm wondering, is that a type of boredom, having the same... it not being interesting? And can boredom be very dangerous when it comes to political choices or choices that we make? Can we end up making very poor decisions because of boredom?
We can. Some of the most interesting and important work on boredom actually comes out of Ireland, from Eric Igu and at the University of Limerick, I think. And his student at the time, Wynand van Tilburg, who's now in the UK at the University of Essex, they've done a lot of work looking at boredom as a sort of sign that we need to find meaning in our lives. So when we, in the throes of boredom, we sort of see either the situation that we're in as being kind of meaningless, Or we might even sort of think more broadly that maybe our life lacks a bit of meaning. And so what that means then is that boredom is pushing us to find a sense of meaning. And they've shown a number of different things. They've shown that people who have strong religious beliefs tend not to get as bored because the religious beliefs provide that framework of meaning. But with respect to politics, they showed some interesting things where if they made people bored, then after being put into that state of boredom, people would double down on their political ideology. So if you were somewhat left-wing before I made you bored, you became more strongly left-wing afterwards. And the same for right-wing, in fact, more strongly for the right-wing people. If you had a right-wing ideology and then I made you bored by doing something like watching two guys hang laundry for 8 minutes, had a stronger commitment to that ideology afterwards. So you became more extreme in your political commitment. It's hard to suggest that from that finding that, you know, there's an easy or simple explanation for why people voted Trump. I think that, or Boris Johnson or Brexit or whatever you might sort of want to say. I think that things are a little bit more complex than that. But certainly that desire to have a sense of meaning in your life will drive people to sort of commit to things that provide them that strong, meaningful framework. And that might not always be the most sensible thing to do.
Dr. James Dankert, Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Waterloo, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us here on the show, you can email us at science@newstalk.com or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. We get to all of your comments in the podcast. Find it in the News Talk app or wherever you find your downloads. Just search for Future Proof. Now, as unpleasant as it might be, fear is a key ingredient to our success as a species. Now, of course, we're not the only animals that experience fear, but do we experience fear in the same way? And how much more do we have to learn about how to manage our response to danger? Well, Daniel T. Blumstein is professor of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UCLA. He's author of The Nature of Fear. Welcome to the program, Daniel. What got you interested in the idea of fear?
Thanks for having me. You know, fear is one of these emotions that we share with many, many other species, and it's a really important emotion, and it's a really important response. If you look at many other species, I study, among other things, anti-predator behavior, how animals avoid predators, and this involves a healthy dose of fear. The fight or flight response is something that we physiologically share with many other vertebrates, and by studying this across many species, I think there are insights that can be gained for understanding our own fears.
You are a behavioral ecologist, Daniel. What exactly is that, and why would a behavioral ecologist be interested in fear?
Behavioral ecology is the study of animal behavior, but we're interested broadly in explaining the diversity of behavior. Why do different species behave differently? Why do some species behave similarly? What's the functional basis of this? Behavioral ecology embraces really the whole modern toolkit of molecular biology and evolutionary biology, along with a healthy dose of field biology. I think that I'm fascinated by the diversity of things animals do. To ask that, the toolkit of behavioral ecology is a good one.
Is there a lot of diversity in how animals other than humans react to fear, or is it all flight, freeze, or fight?
Right. So that's a really good way of summarizing it. But given that pretty much all species have to deal with predators, at least at some point in their life, there's a remarkable diversity of anti-predator behavior. One of the lessons that comes out of studying lots of different species is that you can never eliminate fear. One of the things I do in my career is I like to sort of bring different fields together and look for insights from different fields that can help other fields. And in this case, and in this book, I'm sort of looking for insights that can help explain our behavior and lessons from really the full diversity of life for human behavior. Many evolutionary psychologists will look at maybe the ancestral human environment or maybe look at primate behavior to understand why we behave and how we behave the way we behave. But by looking at the sort of full diversity of life, we really see that one can never eliminate fear. One has to manage it. Yeah. So when we hear politicians fear-mongering, by the way, it works, scaring us that they can make us safe, run the other direction. Don't believe it. What you want is a politician who can say, we have challenges, we have risks, but now let's figure out a way to manage those risks.
I want to get into the sort of existential fear in a bit, but you said there's lots of diversity. Can you give us some example of those in the animal kingdom, how different animals respond to fear in unique ways?
Well, if we look at anti-predator behavior, we have some animals that hide in burrows. We have other animals that run quickly away from their predators. They don't have the safety of a burrow to hide in. We have animals that have morphological adaptations like camouflage, so they blend in. You end up seeing suites of behaviors. So if you're walking towards animals to scare them, something I've done a lot over the years with lots of different species, camouflaged animals let you come very close to them. Well, that makes sense, because if you're camouflaged, you're relying on crypsis to avoid being detected. Whereas other animals that might be more brightly colored are more likely to flee at a greater distance. So we see diversity. We see diversity within individuals at different times in their life, at different ages. We see diversity in risk tolerance based on what we would call life history adaptations. So some species have lots of kids early and die young, and other species sort of pace their lives and live much longer. And there can be different strategies and risk tolerances for these different sorts of species.
I remember interviewing someone on the program, and they were trying to shoot sort of very nervy animals up close. And what they would do is they would paint their cameras like the animal that they were trying to get close to, or in some other way camouflage them. And I noticed that sometimes you don't have to mimic that animal very well to trigger the response that you want. And I'm wondering, when it comes to fear, is it just a small trigger that causes these animals to respond? Can it be just something as simple as a sound or a flash of color? Or when an animal reacts scared, is it a number of things that eventually lead to it to flee?
Great question. So, I mean, if you're thinking about detecting predators and you need to have a rapid response, we often have pretty rapid responses to fearful sorts of stimuli. So in the book, I have a chapter basically on the sight of fear, the sound of fear, and the smell of fear. And in these chapters, I look at the cues, whether they're olfactory cues or auditory cues or visual cues that seem to elicit anti-predator behavior in a variety of species. So for example, many species respond to approaching objects. And you can simulate this on a computer screen with a dot, a black dot that gets bigger. Many species are really good at estimating time to impact and will, you know, move away from that. And if you then say, well, you know, what is it aside from a dot that is scary? It turns out for many vertebrates, two frontally placed eyes are particularly alarming. So eye spots are alarming. Why are eye spots alarming? Because many predators have binocular vision. And when the eyes are getting closer to you, you should be going the other direction. So this can lead to a pretty innate response. Many species are afraid of snakes. And I talk about stories. The book's peppered with stories. I talk about a story about a pet crow that I had. Everybody should have a pet crow. They're too smart. They sort of humiliate us in their intelligence. But this crow was living in our lab, and it was going around and was creating quite a mess around our computers. And this was in the day when, you know, everyone had a tower computer and had a little red button, and the crow would peck the red button because we were ignoring it. It was very social and really liked interacting with us. And it would peck the red button, which would cause the computer to restart. And that led to a huge response from us. So one of my office mates noticed that every time the janitor came in, when he came in with a broom, the crow would freak out. And she's like, I wonder if the crow thinks the broom is a snake. So she went out and she bought tomato steaks from a garden supply store, and she put those around her computer and on her desk where she wanted to keep the crow from getting on her desk. Boom, Bob's your uncle, worked perfectly. So we started covering things we didn't want the crow to land on and harass with tomato steaks, with little sticks. Well, I think the crow was responding and thought that the sticks might've been like snakes. And there's reasons that animals should, I mean, the stick looked nothing really like a snake, but there was something there that probably led to an innate response. When I say innate, I mean it's a response that doesn't require experience to be performed. Mm. In the sound of fear, I talk about how noise or the result of systems sort of being blown into their non-linear phase. Think about turning up your radio, it gets louder and louder and louder, and at some point it starts getting distorted. The system sort of it's in a specific state space, what's called a non-linear space, and there's predictable unpredictability. Well, this happens when animals scream. So when animals scream, they overblow their vocal cords, they overblow their vocal production units, and this leads to particular sorts of sounds, including sounds that sound kind of noisy. And it turns out that if you look at human movies, particularly horror films, you know, they're chock full of these particular non-linearities, things like noise, and they're very evocative to us.
Yeah, it's I mean, I used to work as a film reviewer, and the discordant music, the music that didn't sound harmonious, and often often use that sort of awkward violin scrape, you can see why that has an innate response from humans, because it is that sort of distortion of sound that we sometimes hear in times of danger.
Yep, and it sort of goes back to our the insight I had that sort of got me down this whole research program was I went a long-term study of marmots, big ground squirrels in Colorado. We're about to start our 60th year next year. And wow. I was holding a baby marmot once, and it screamed in my hands, and I had this emotional response and almost dropped it. And I hear baby marmots alarm call all the time, but I never heard them scream until that point. And they don't do it a lot. And I wasn't hurting it. And we don't hurt the animals. And I was like, wow, why did I have an emotional response to a little rodent? Well, it turns out that, you know, baby foxes, baby deer, baby marmots, baby people all scream. And screams, as I said, create these particular sorts of noises. So we respond to them in a very conserved way, which is fascinating. So by studying marmots and by studying marmot communication, I gained insight into why we respond, I think, the way we respond to certain sounds.
So essentially what you're saying is that there are triggers that could be sound, they could be sight, they could be smell, that make certain animals just feel fear instantly. Are there equivalents in human beings? Is there a certain smell that universally causes dread in humans? Is there a sight that typically terrifies us?
Great question. And I think that, so the sounds, I think we have the sounds. I think the sights, we respond to rapidly approaching objects. We respond to snakes, and we have an innate response to snakes. And I review studies that actually, and spiders, and I reviewed studies that look at sort of developmental psychology studies where people work with little kids. And I sort of, you know, wonder myself, you know, who would let their kids go and do these experiments? But, you know, babies respond to snakes and spiders as well. So yes, visually and acoustically, I think we share some of these responses. Doing the research, I didn't find good evidence that we respond innately to smells, but it hasn't been studied as much. And there are smells that other species respond to, particular chemicals. And it would be fascinating to sort of experiment with this in humans. And I have some reason to believe that we actually might be able to discriminate at least predators from non-predators, but whether it scares us in the same way or we just can tell the difference between them, I don't know.
Yeah. Talking about different types of fear, obviously, a worry that we're going to be harmed, that, you know, we'll experience some sort of tissue or organ damage, is one type of fear. But then there are other types of fear, like dread, like the sort of fear we get that's more long term when we listen to, as you say, sort of propaganda that makes us worry about the state of the world. Are those scientifically or neurologically very distinct types of fear? Can we really call the second one that isn't about immediate danger, can we really call that fear?
It's a really good question. So certainly humans are, you know, complex in different ways than non-humans. You know, we have different emotions than I would say some other species have. We have, for example, you know, Schadenfreude. I don't think other species have Schadenfreude, but every species has fear. When you start getting into social anxiety and social fears and things like that, there are probably other neurological systems involved in this and neurochemical systems involved in this. But we do see, for many of these sorts of fears, we see similar chemical responses. We see stress hormones being increased. We see activity in particular parts of the brain, the amygdala. Not saying it's only that, and then not saying that other things can't be part of that, but we do see part of, you know, these fear circuits, if you will, and these fear chemicals being deployed. Fear can work as a motivator, probably in certain contexts, but you can't be afraid all the time. I mean, the lesson is, if we listen to our inner marmot, you know, at some point you got to leave your burrow. There, as a behavioral ecologist, I sort of view the world and simplify the world by saying, okay, well, you know, you can stay in your burrow and never leave and starve to death, or you can go out and be incautious and be killed. And the game of life is figuring out those trade-offs, how to minimize risk while out, while still getting necessary resources and things like that. And I think, you know, not only is one of the lessons from looking at the whole diversity of animal life that you can't eliminate risk, the other big take-home message is risk is contextual and trade-offs are ubiquitous.
You talked about the physiological response that happens with fear, and I think people will be very familiar with the idea of fight or flight, that cortisol levels go up, that blood leaves our extremities and goes to the organs that need it most. We stop producing saliva because it's not as useful, and essentially the body primes itself to fight, putting all of the energy into the muscles. But I'm wondering if there's anything else that a fear response provokes, because there are stories of people doing extraordinary feats of strength and bravery as a result of a very terrifying situation. Have you seen evidence for this? Because it typically tends to be anecdotal. And can animals perform feats of strength or unusual physical abilities as a result of being afraid?
Well, I can only talk from an anecdote, which I opened the book with, which was in 1986. I was sort of studying monkey behavior in Kenya, but I was paid to go around and bicycle in Kenya. So I split my time bicycling and studying monkey behavior. And I was on the coast bicycling alone out of Mombasa, going south towards the Tanzanian border to go to some parks and to go to some beaches. And I'm bicycling along this empty road, and my bike is completely loaded down with water, and it's hot, and food, because I sort of had all my supplies for a while. And I'm going up this hill very slowly, and I see these three guys on the side of the road, and I say Jambo, hello to them, and they didn't respond. And as I sort of bike close to them, I sort of out of the corner of my eye caught that they were lifting up this large rock and were throwing it at me. And somehow it didn't hit me on the head, and I sort of moved my head and shoulder, and it hit me on my shoulder, but my bike was so heavily loaded with supplies, I wasn't knocked over. And I just had the most intense adrenaline rush of my life, and they chased me, and I biked up this hill and out of, and got away from them. I was terrified. So I think when animals are, equally terrified, I mean, that was a really good adrenaline rush. I mean, adrenaline is a wonderful thing. And feeling your nostrils open and your eyes open and all the blood, go to your muscles and all your energy goes to your muscles is amazing. And you actually can do, superhuman things in certain times. When animals are escaping from predators and under duress, I'm sure similar things are happening. So I think that this can lead to, and it's very adaptive to lead to these sorts of responses. Now, these responses are really costly. And you can't maintain them forever, which is why chronic stress is so bad. You can't not have your immune system working. You can't just be putting all of your energy into certain muscles and not grow or not reproduce or be running all the time. So there are cumulative costs to being too afraid.
When it comes to our own behavior, obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and there's a general fear, but not all of it is rational. Are there ways of overcoming irrational fear that are very successful? Because you hear about people who are, afraid to take an airplane and they never shake it off. We're now in sort of a long-lasting period of semi-rational fear. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think there are a lot of lessons from thinking about the diversity of anti-predator behavior and fear for dealing with COVID. As I said before, one of the lessons from life is that context is everything, and different individuals face different risks. I'm in my mid-50s, I face different risks than the college students that I face should I get COVID. So rational responses vary. And public health messengers, public health officials need to understand that, and they do, of course, that you need to target different people with different messages. One of the other lessons from life is that in many cases, it's good to be better safe than sorry. It's good to overestimate risk. And we see this across the animal kingdom, including in humans, where many, I believe, of our cognitive biases that we have are really design features to ensure safety and security. So overestimating risk a little bit is
it's not as bad as you might think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keeps us safe. Shelter in place, as you say over there, or stay indoors, as we say here.
The other message is, of course, that we need to be really careful about fatigue and COVID fatigue, that we habituate to fears. All animals habituate if there is not a sort of a real reinforcement. One of my colleagues says, because we're not seeing bodies in the street, we habituate much more quickly. Whereas in previous eras, when the ability to deal with dead people was much better, people would pile up during pandemics, and that would really scare people. We're not seeing that now. And if we did, in some places, maybe that would change behavior in different ways.
Mm. Although it would be a pretty extreme communications tactic, but who knows what the future holds. Professor Blumstein from UCLA, author of The Nature of Fear, Survival Lessons from the Wild. Good luck with the book, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Have you ever been like really afraid for your life? What happened? Tell me that story. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. We'll get to that in the podcast. That's it from us for this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks to the production team, Aidan McKelvey, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt, and Stephen McClune. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof, of course, in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Off the Ball is up next. Have a great weekend.